With great power comes great responsibility.
Compromise where you can. Where you can't, don't. Even if everyone is telling you that something wrong is something right, even if the whole world is telling you to move, it is your duty to plant yourself like a tree, look them in the eye and say, no, you move.
Never step onto the battlefield of ideas unprepared. Before you enter the fray, you need a plan. And there's no better place to get one than right here on Tactics with host Caleb Colquitt. The Situation Room goes live now on News Radio 1440.
Hey, and welcome in, everybody. I do have to apologize for not being able to get on the air on time. We had an Auburn baseball game and having a little problems, but everything's running smoothly now. So if you do want to listen to Auburn baseball, that's on News Radio 1440 right now. Otherwise, you stay here with me. But thank you so much for joining us on this Tuesday. We appreciate so much you choosing to make us part of your day every single day and that you trust us to bring you all the local and national news. And this day, of course, is no exception. I have a theory that I want to float to everybody. I think that Roy Moore might actually be immortal. And I don't mean immortal in the sense that you could shoot him and he wouldn't die. I'm talking about this guy has more political vitality than anybody that I've ever met. And the reason that I say that is not because I think that he's a wonderful candidate. Obviously, he lost his last election against a Democrat in the reddest state in the country. So I'm not saying that he's a politically good candidate. What I am saying is somehow, for some reason, it doesn't seem that anything can stop this guy from being very popular amongst certain people. I'm not sure why necessarily that is, but despite everything that's happened to Roy Moore, and I'm not just talking about the allegations in the last election, I'm talking about over decades. This guy has had several career-ending events. Any other politician, I'm convinced that these things happen to, Roy Moore would be done. And I'm not sure exactly why. And by the way, I don't want you to misconstrue this. I'm not saying that necessarily the allegations are true or any of that. I'm just saying that whether the allegations are true or not, typically speaking, because there was some plausibility there, anything like that would end a normal politician's career. And so would the Ten Commandments thing, and so would getting thrown off of the Supreme Court the way that he did for his executive, not even an executive order, just basically an executive memo after the Obergefell case when it came to issuing marriage licenses for gay couples. Generally speaking, any of those things, regardless of the motivations, regardless of whether you thought he was right or wrong, would be the end of any other politician's career. And yet somehow, I don't know exactly why, I can't put my finger on what that X factor is, but Roy Moore seems to be at the point to where nothing can stop this guy from at the very least being relevant as a part of the conversation. And I have to be honest, I would not have believed this if you had told it to me, because I really thought that his political career was basically done after that last election, especially because his nomination in the primaries resulted in the election of Senator Doug Jones. But new numbers tell a very different story when you're looking at polling data. Now, if you're looking at this, to give you a little bit of context here, I do want to be clear, Roy Moore has not announced that he is running. He has not said, he's been questioned about it, and he's kind of given some vague answers, but he has not said that he is running for the Senate seat that is currently occupied by Doug Jones, who beat him in the last special election. He has not announced his candidacy. And yet, he is leading in a new Mason-Dixon poll. So this Mason-Dixon poll, which took 400 likely Alabama voters, has Roy Moore in the lead on the Republican side. No, you didn't mishear me. This is actually happening again. Roy Moore is actually leading the polls, which just absolutely blows my mind. But somehow, this guy, Teflon doesn't even describe how vivacious the political lifespan of Roy Moore must be. I mean, nothing can kill this guy. It's like a zombie or something. Every time you take a shot, he just gets right back up and he keeps coming. And again, I'm not trying to disparage him. I'm just saying that politically, anybody else would have had their careers ended because of this. And somehow Roy Moore keeps going. He just, you think that he's politically gone and he just keeps coming back somehow. So in this poll, Roy Moore took 27% of the vote. Mo Brooks got 18%, and Bradley Byrne, who, by the way, Bradley Byrne is the only person in this poll that has actually announced a Senate run. And despite that, he's still in third place with 13%. So not way behind Mo Brooks, but significantly behind Mo Brooks. And if I were Mo Brooks and I was actually thinking about running, and I don't have any insider information, so don't, you know, put more emphasis on this than you really should. But when it comes to Mo Brooks, I don't know whether he's going to run or not, but if I were Mo Brooks and I were contemplating a Senate run, honestly, what I would probably do right now is stay low and continue to build sort of a, basically just keep doing what I'm doing and wait until a little bit closer to election time to announce, because typically speaking, and this is a political truism, especially in a primary, your best day is the day that you announce. Generally, people shoot up in the polls after they've announced their candidacy and start to taper off a little bit because of the excitement factor goes down. And if he wants to maximize that excitement factor, if he wants to get that at the most that he possibly can right now, and it's hard to tell which way the political winds will shift, but if I were Mo Brooks' campaign advisor, I would tell him to wait it out just a little longer, maybe about a year before the election, and then announce. And try to maximize your potential to move ahead in the polls. But nonetheless, Roy Moore is beating him by almost 10 percentage points. That's significant. 9 percentage points is a big, big lead in a primary. And so, I'm just kind of dumbfounded, to be honest. I do not understand how Roy Moore does this political comeback. And I don't hate the man, and I don't wish ill on him or his family. He's never done anything wrong to me or anything like that. I'm just saying, good gracious, how is he doing this? And I also have another pressing question. Where's Tubbs? Tommy Tuberville, as you may remember, we announced on this show, he announced his candidacy, oddly enough, via Twitter. And he is going to be running for that open Senate seat. And yet Tuberville is nowhere ranked among these. Now, maybe, and I'm guessing this is probably what happened, the poll was actually conducted before Tuberville formally announced, and nobody was just thinking to include him in the questionnaire, because it did come out of left field, even though he's a football coach. But nonetheless, a little sports pun there, but it really did come out of left field. Nobody was expecting that. I certainly wasn't. And so Tuberville coming in, I don't know how much he shakes up this poll or if he even makes a difference at all. It's just impossible to tell. But based on this poll, which does not include him, it looks like Roy Moore is taking 27% of the vote. And I really don't see the injection of Tommy Tuberville making much of a difference in that, to be perfectly honest. So then the question becomes, how do we explain this? Because according to all conventional political wisdom, this doesn't make any sense. There's no way to sugarcoat it. This makes no sense from a normal political calculation. Somebody that has that conventional wisdom, it just doesn't make sense. And granted, conventional wisdom isn't always right. Donald Trump is living, breathing proof of that. But my point in this is, if you can't go to that for an explanation, you've got to kind of think outside the box. So I'm going to try to kind of parse through these and bounce some ideas off of you, see what you think. First is that the general population, they're not real politically savvy. And regardless of the fact that Roy Moore, as we've seen many times over, is garbage in a general election, he tends to get a very strong, very loud, vocal support amongst Republicans, but only amongst certain Republicans. And so that's something that you can kind of see that can propel him to the lead in a primary, especially a crowded primary, as we saw in the last round, but not something that really propels you to victory in a general election. And so, because the average person in this poll might have a very strong favorability towards Roy Moore, those are the kind of people that are not going to be enough to get him in the general election because he has a high unlikability rating, which we'll get to in a second as well. But the general population typically doesn't think in those terms. And so because of that, even though this technically is actually a political career ender, as it were, there is a small but loyal following within the Republican base that doesn't care about that. And that's why he's continuing to lead, even though he's really not a viable candidate. Okay, and another explanation would be that, and I think that this one has a lot to do with it, name recognition is really the only thing that matters in the state of Alabama. I hate to say it, but it's the truth. The average voter just is not on top of things. They don't study these candidates. And so they generally, when it comes time to vote, they just mark the name that they recognize. I get that that's terrible, and I wish that it were different, but it's not. If anything, the last round of elections proved that the single most important thing in the state of Alabama is name recognition, because if you go down the ballot, whichever candidate had most name recognition always won. To my knowledge, there was not an exception to that rule in the last statewide general election. I mean, the numbers don't lie. Only 4% of people in this poll did not recognize Roy Moore. Now, there were some people that really didn't like Roy Moore in this poll, but the point is there were only 4 people that didn't recognize his name. And that means that he's winning the name recognition game by a lot. And that does have a very serious effect on people. Now, there's some negative that comes with that, too, because that means that a lot of people have already made up their mind on Roy Moore one way or the other. So the people that like him really like him, and the people that don't like him really don't like him. But the point is, there's very little chance that his numbers are going to change a whole lot from that 27%, because there's only 4% of people that haven't made their mind up on him. Another one, Mo Brooks has a 23%. Name recognition. There are 23% of people that don't recognize his name, in other words. Sorry, I probably didn't word that as eloquently as I should have, but there were 23% of people polled that had no idea who Mo Brooks was. Now, granted, that's pretty good, but it's nowhere near 4%. And so name recognition seems to win the day for Roy Moore, and Bradley Byrne, who's also running, has a 46% of people that do not recognize him, so almost half of these 400 voters in Alabama that were polled from all over the state, almost half had no idea who Bradley Byrne is. And that's why, despite being the only one of these candidates that's formally announced his candidacy, he's still in third place by a pretty good ways. And I have nothing against Bradley Byrne. I think he'd actually be a pretty good senator. I don't think he'd be as good as Mo Brooks, but I think he'd be pretty good. But nonetheless, the numbers just show that the single biggest contributing factor, the single biggest determiner of whether or not people want to vote for this person or not, has to do with, do I recognize their name? I mean, is it silly? Yes, but it's the way that things are. It's reality. Another thing that we can look at is that it was not a Republican-only poll, which I think played a role in it as well, which means that even though I don't know that this is something that happened real often in this, presumably what they were doing here is that they were not excluding the Democrat voters on this. And there were some Democrats in this poll, because 45% of the people polled wanted to reelect Doug Jones, which honestly is pretty good for Doug Jones. 45% is definitely not as much as he would need to win the general. But if he's doing it 45 right now, he's really not doing all that poorly. But you also have to consider that if 45% of the people wanted to reelect Jones, don't you think that if I was a Doug Jones voter, and I'm looking at this Republican pool and thinking, who would I want Doug Jones to run against? Well, of course I pick Roy Moore. Roy Moore has already been defeated by Doug Jones once. And like I said, his political career, especially with a lot of the voters in Alabama, is basically done. They wouldn't vote for Roy Moore no matter what. And so because of that, Roy Moore is the best chance of getting Doug Jones reelected. And so there are going to be Doug Jones voters that look at that and see that, and they go, I'd really like to vote for Roy Moore because maybe that'll boost his poll numbers. Now, do I think that that's a huge determining factor? I don't really know, but it's possible. And so his numbers could be somewhat inflated based on the fact that there are Democrats looking at this and thinking, well, I want to vote for Roy Moore because I think that Doug Jones has the best chance to defeat him. And by the way, one thing that was significant that got brought up in this is that Roy Moore did the best amongst women. Now, I don't think of this as an impossibility, and I really don't think that a lot of people, even some people on the left, actually bought into this ridiculous allegation that was completely unproven and basically her word against his about him being a pedophile or any of that stuff or being a sexual predator. And so from that standpoint, that finding didn't surprise me all that much, but it would explain that the more liberal you are, the more likely you are to vote for Roy Moore because you really want Doug Jones elected. And so you put your vote in for Roy Moore in the survey because that's the person you would most like to see Doug Jones go against. And if that's true, that would explain the discrepancy of female voters as they tend to vote more for Democrats. And it's not a huge discrepancy, but the discrepancy is there. Again, I can't prove this. It's just a theory. But it is a theory that has some numbers to back it up and actually would make a lot of sense. And here's the thing. Some people might look at that and say, well, Caleb, if you're right about that, then we should just discredit it because they're not going to be voting if they're Democrats in the Republican primary. Won't they? And here's what I mean by that. Doug Jones is pretty much a shoe-in to win the Democrat nomination. I can't see any Democrat challenger even showing up, much less actually giving a serious challenge to Doug Jones. And the way it works in the state of Alabama is we technically have open primaries. It's just you can only vote for one side. You don't have to register. You just are given a ballot based on whoever you want to vote for. You walk up and you say, Republican, please, or Democrat, please. And if that's the case, you don't think that there is going to be at least some, and I would guess several, people that actually want Doug Jones to be reelected to the Senate that are going to say, give me a Republican ballot, because they want to vote for somebody like Roy Moore that they believe would be easier to defeat because their guy's basically going to get it walking away anyway, and they may have to forego voting in Democrat primaries down ballot. I don't know, but the point is, it's going to make a significant difference here, and it may make a significant difference come election day. Maybe it doesn't, but that would be my guess right now. That would be my guess, that if this winds up playing out the way that I think it might, Roy Moore is probably going to get at least somewhat of a boost from Democrats that are going to try to go on the other side and vote for the person they think is easiest to defeat, and there are going to be at least some that do that. I have no idea how many that would be, but I'm telling you it's going to happen, and which is why I say that it's kind of a combination of all the possibilities that I've been talking about so far. And here's another factor that I think is playing into this. The revenge factor is going to be a part of it as well. In fact, and this is by no means scientific, it's just sort of a general question that I was asking, and people that I've spoken to about this that are supporting Roy Moore, they're rationale for most of them boils down to, well, he got served a raw deal in the last election, which, by the way, is not incorrect. The way that the media handled it, the way that the left, Nancy Pelosi famously referring to him as a pedophile, of course, you know, it was always just allegations when it was Al Franken, but I won't get into all that right now. But the way that the left referred to him as though he absolutely did these things and there was no doubt about it, and the way that the media constantly went after him because they wanted Doug Jones to get elected, yeah, he got a raw deal. I don't think anybody that is somewhat objective when it comes to this would say that he didn't. I don't. But the thing is, the fact that he got a raw deal should not be a determining factor in whether or not he's the person that you vote for this time. The revenge vote is a silly thing. It makes no sense to vote for a candidate because you feel that they were wronged in a previous election. That's the way a toddler thinks. You're not using your rational mind when you say that, well, he got a raw deal last time, so I'm going to vote for him this time. I'll show them. You know, why don't you just vote for the most conservative candidate? Why don't you just vote for somebody that actually reflects your values? Now, if that happens to be Roy Moore, you know, fine. But what I'm saying here is, don't vote for Roy Moore because you feel that he got a raw deal last time. If you really do think that your values line up with his, vote for him because of that, not because you think that the allegations were false, because I don't know that there was a whole lot to the allegations either. And I treated him in that election as though he was innocent, because I do believe in the principle of innocent until proven guilty. But nonetheless, regardless of all that, I still don't think that you ought to make him your ideal candidate just because you think he was done unfairly in the last one. It really doesn't make any sense. Voting based on a grudge or voting based on your emotions is something that people on the left do, not something that people on the right are supposed to do. And one last thing I will say about this before I go. A study shows that actually Mo Brooks is still the best bet to unseat Doug Jones. And here's why. They did a favorability, unfavorability rating in this survey as well. Roy Moore currently stands at 34% favorable and 29% unfavorable. So that means his unfavorability numbers are almost as high as his favorability. And like I said, there's no surprises with Roy Moore. Basically, everybody that has an opinion on him already has an opinion, and that's not going to be changed. By contrast, Brooks only has a 27% favorability rate, lower than Roy Moore's, but it's still only 8% unfavorable and 23% unknown. That means that Brooks has a lot of room to gain voters. Roy Moore really doesn't. The hay's basically already in the barn for him, whereas Mo Brooks, as long as he gets to go center stage and put his ideas out there, there are a lot of people that don't know him or don't know what he stands for that can be drawn into voting for him. The same cannot be said for Roy Moore. So while Roy Moore is still winning on the favorability side, he has much higher unfavorability ratings, and Mo Brooks has a lot more room to grow in that favorability rating than Roy Moore does. And he's the most experienced and the most conservative candidate. I mean, he hasn't even formally announced yet, neither is Roy Moore, but if you've got to pick between the two, it's a no-brainer. You have to go with Mo Brooks just because he's the most likely to win, he's the most experienced, he's the most conservative, he's the most competent out of all the people that are in the potential field right now. Judge Moore has done some really good things for the state in the past, and I appreciate it. But the best thing that he could do right now to make sure that Doug Jones is no longer the senator from Alabama is to say that he's not running. That would be the best case scenario right now. I don't hold any grudges towards him, I don't hate him, and I don't think that he's a pedophile, but I still think that he's a terrible candidate, and him jumping into the race would not be a good thing for the state of Alabama. All right, so it looks like we've got a caller on, so we'll go ahead and go there. Good afternoon. What's on your mind?
First, I vehemently disagree with you, and you're only talking about two people. There is another one that is lurking out there, too.
Well, the reason that I did not mention him is because he was not mentioned in the poll, which I think is actually wrong, but he still hasn't been mentioned.
Yeah, well, the poll's stupid then, because I think you can build a case for Jim Ziegler.
No, I, you know that I love Jim Ziegler. I think that he would be a good senator.
But
he also hasn't formally announced yet.
No, he hasn't. But here's something about him. I think you can build an incredible case for what he has accomplished in the past and his experience in the past. I really do. If you sit and think about some of the things that he's been involved with, and if there's been any negativity about him, I don't remember it. And I'm sure they'll find something if he throws his hat in the ring in this thing, and that's where he goes. And I know he's exploring that right now.
Well, they'll find something or they'll make it up. You're right about that.
Yeah. And if that's the case, I don't know. But the track record that he has, all kidding aside, and I know I say some of this tongue-in-cheek, but I really do like the guy. And I do really insist that there have been a number of things. You can't have anyone that has more different kinds of experience in government than he's had.
That's true.
I mean, he's held a lot of different kinds of jobs. And then some of the things that he has unearthed since he's been in his positions, too, is quite an accomplishment, really.
And I will say this, if you're looking at political viability, and I do think he's conservative, I do think his policies would be good, but as far as the question of could he win or not, you do have to remember that even though I really like Mo Brooks, Mo Brooks has never won a statewide election. Jim Ziegler has won several. And that is a big difference.
It is a big difference because he has people all over the state.
Mm-hmm.
Because you already have people in place in every county and every town in Alabama because of that. He does have people out there, I would think, that are it's much more widespread than you would have with Mo Brooks. I like him, too. I'll vote for either one of them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I'd vote for my niece, 4 years old, over what's in there now.
Yeah, I'd think that just about anybody would be better than Doug Jones, but...
Yeah, because he is horrific. Even if it were a Democrat that at least had some independence and had his own mind, but he doesn't like the state with which he represents.
That's one thing that really baffles me, is that despite seemingly having a disdain for Alabama and not wanting any influence from people from Alabama in the form of ideas, values, or even funding, mm-hmm. somehow in this survey, 45% of people still said they want to reelect Doug Jones, and that just blows my mind.
Well, he needs to get into a good race with a candidate and without all the drama that we had last time. And I do think that you're right about, I think Roy Moore is damn as good.
And
there's a lot I like about the guy, too. I really do.
Right.
I've met him. I'm impressed with him. And some of the things in his track record are really impressive. They actually are. But I can't.
Right.
I think
the guy's a patriot. He served his country. He was a good chief justice. I'm not saying he's a terrible person. But what I am saying is, if you're looking at his political viability, he is by far the best chance that Doug Jones has at being a senator for a second term.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to go with somebody else because we've got to get Doug Jones out of there.
Yeah. Well, I've noticed in my lifetime, there has to be timing has to be right for everything.
Sure.
And there are certain people that just can't. Barack Obama, for example, was the right candidate at the right time.
Absolutely.
With a perfect storm for it to. And he really was. Same could be said for Clinton and other candidates too. Reagan, it was a perfect situation for him to go in such a weak ruler. But I mean, even in a statewide election, I mean, I think that's true with that too. And there needs to be a freshness about somebody. And you say, well, that's contradictory because you're talking about Ziegler, but Ziegler's never aspired to an office of that height before. There's a lot of difference in being on the Public Service Commission or being the treasurer or something like that, as opposed to your secretary, as opposed to being a U.S. senator.
There is a big difference there, but I got to say, one thing that I do like about Ziegler and his candidacy is because he's done such a variety of jobs, and the guy is a policy wonk. That's what he is. He's not mm-hmm. somebody that's necessarily, even though I think he's funny and has a good personality, he's not fluffy. He's not, you know, just an empty shell. The guy actually, he likes crunching numbers and looking for corruption, and that's sort of his wheelhouse. And so I think he'd be a great candidate. I am actually kind of surprised that he didn't even register in this poll. But nonetheless, I think that, you know, you bring up a good point that Jim Ziegler wasn't in here. But you're right that either one of them would just be miles and miles better than Doug Jones.
If I'm Ziegler running against Mo Brooks, for example, I'm running against the swamp. And I think he can pull that off, to be a D.C. insider and that kind of thing, which seems to resonate with people. And I think he can do that.
I think that's incorrect, because I don't think that Mo Brooks is typically what you think
of as
establishment D.C. But if Mitch McConnell, of all people, can pull off a disinformation campaign and make people think that Mo Brooks is part of the swamp, then Jim Ziegler certainly could.
I think so, too.
I mean, Mitch McConnell is like the definition of a swamp person, and somehow he pulled that off. But anyway, all right. Well, thank you so much for your input. I appreciate it. All right. One other thing that I wanted to mention, since we are talking about the state of Alabama, Richard Shelby came out the other day and talked about his tax proposal. And he has kind of done this under the radar, but I want to give him some kudos. And I know normally when I bring up Richard Shelby, it's to criticize him, but I got to give him a lot of props for this one. So the other day, of course, tax day, April 15th, a lot of people were talking about it. Richard Shelby the guy is not known for his consistency. He's just not. He's had tons of different positions. He even changed parties. When he first went into office as a senator, he was a Democrat. He switched to the Republican side. He used to be a lot more moderate. Now he's more conservative. He's gone back and forth on several different issues. The man is not somebody that's necessarily known for his consistency. I'm not saying that he's known as a flip-flopper either, but he's certainly not somebody that you can look to and like, man, that guy is a model of consistency. But you know what? He has been on this issue, and I want to give him a lot of props for it, and it's a good position to take. So the other day, he introduced to the Senate the Simplified, Manageable, and Responsible Tax, or the SMART Act. And he has done this every single year since he took office in 1986. To put that into perspective, that was 3 years before I was born. He has been doing this for 33 years. And I think that he's made a handful of tweaks and modifications to the bill, but more or less, it's exactly the same bill that he presented in the 1980s. And the thing is, it's actually pretty good. You can't knock the man for inconsistency on this issue. When it comes to taxes, Richard Shelby has been the same person for 33 years. And to just give you an idea about this, I'll let him speak in his own words. In an interview yesterday, Richard Shelby said, "Every year, tax day is a reminder to the American people that our nation's tax code is complex, confusing, and costly." Amen. The recent success of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act is certainly progress, but if the SMART Act was in place now, taxpayers would file a return the size of a postcard, and every American would be taxed equally and at the same rate. I believe this legislation would result in an immediate tax cut for virtually all taxpayers, while also reducing the size, scope, and complexity of the IRS. Well, well said, Richard Shelby. All the praise in the world for that one. So what does this thing actually do? Let's dig into the meat and potatoes here. The flat tax that it would put in place would be a 17% rate. Now, personally, I would prefer something more like a 10% tax rate or something more like Rand Paul was suggesting, a 14.5% flat tax rate. So I think 17's a little high, but there is no question that 17 is way leagues better than what we've got right now. A flat 17 rate across the board, I think, would be an amazing, amazing step towards getting to that 10% rate that I would like. And even if we don't, it's still a vast improvement over the current system. And under his rate, unlike the hundreds of thousands of different deductions and the way that you qualify or don't qualify or all these other complicated things, it includes only four deductions. I would rather there be none, but I do like the four deductions that he has in place. So it would be about $14,000 for a single person, roughly $18,000 for the head of the household, about $28,000 for a married couple filing jointly, and roughly $6,000 for each dependent. So you would get a sizable discount if you have a large family. You would get a sizable discount if you're married. There are deductions that are in place. And you'll notice that this would apply to just about everybody in these deductions, because if you're single, the head of the household, or married, that fits almost everybody. So there's very few people that don't fall into one of those categories. In fact, I don't even know that there would be a situation. Maybe there is, I don't know. But I don't even think there is a situation where you wouldn't fall into at least one of those categories. And so this would be a deduction of even greater proportion after that 17% flat tax rate. And the way that this would work, because of course when you have exact numbers like this, it would be problematic to keep that sustained. But in this bill, the consumer price index would compensate for inflation. So essentially what happens, the consumer price index, it's a number that they try to compare cost of things, cost of products over a amount of time to compensate for inflation and decide how much the value of a dollar has gone up or down. And so because of that, and recognizing that this is something that would need to adjust with the inflation rate, what Richard Shelby has actually proposed is that they would adjust automatically instead of having to pass new deduction rates every single time, there was a fluctuation. So he's actually already planned that, but I mean, you're looking at this law, and it can't be very long, maybe a couple of pages. There are literally tens of thousands of pages of the U.S. federal tax code. It's incredibly complicated, so complicated that there was, I think maybe about 3 years ago, there was an organization that made up a pretend person, and they gave him essentially, they gave him a specific set of how many kids he had, whether he was married or not, all these other things, just like he were a real person, everything that would be relevant to taxation. And they sent that exact same information to over 200 different accountants. You know, accountants that are working independently, accountants that work for a firm, whatever. They did not get a single one back where they got the same results. That's how insanely complicated the tax code is. That 200 accountants that are licensed to do this, that are experts in this field, still couldn't come back with the same numbers. That's how insane our tax code is. And yet we continue to have that. What Richard Shelby is proposing here would essentially get rid of all of that. I mean, it really, really would, and would do go a long way in it doing exactly what he claimed it would, which would be reducing the size and scope of the IRS. I mean, if this is our tax law, and it's just this objective, and it's just about numbers, the IRS could basically be whittled down to some guys in a mailroom and two dudes in a cubicle. That would be essentially all. That's maybe a bit of an exaggeration, but you got to tell, if that is what the tax code is, then there's very little need for this massive staff that they have. You could greatly reduce the scope of it. And what's more important, you would reduce the power of it. You would reduce its ability to abuse others. And especially being here in Central Alabama and the Wetumpka Tea Party being such an active political group and one of the ones that was targeted in the IRS targeting scam under Barack Obama, where he was going after his political enemies and using the IRS as a bludgeon, as a tool to punish those who disagreed with him in the lead up to his reelection efforts. I mean, you look at how rife the IRS is with corruption and how it could be used incorrectly. Now, that's a good reason to get rid of its power in the first place. Because if we were under this tax code, no matter how much Barack Obama may have wanted to abuse his power, it would have been virtually impossible for him to do that. Because the IRS would have been so much smaller, there would have been less room for him to be able to do that. And there's yet less bureaucracy and red tape as well. And so one of the big advantages to decreasing the size and the power of the IRS would not only be that it saves taxpayer money, but it also protects against potential abuses. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, because this isn't just something that would affect Barack Obama. I know that there's no evidence that this is going on. I'm not suggesting that he is, but let's just say that Donald Trump wanted to go after George Soros or the Code Pink or the Open Societies Foundation or Think Progress, or any of these liberal think tanks that don't like him, he could, you know, potentially do exactly the same thing and abuse the IRS and use them as a tool to punish his political enemies. This isn't a right or left issue. The IRS needs to be taken down a peg, if nothing else, to reduce the potential of political corruption. That is something that everybody ought to be able to get on board with. And one thing that Senator Shelby also said, the SMART Act would also allow for businesses to redirect resources away from tax compliance and instead focus on expanding their businesses and creating jobs. Yeah, I mean, if you don't have to pay a team of accountants to do your taxes every single year, that is going to save you quite a bit of money. So you're not only saving money on the end of we're paying less in taxes, but you're also saving money on the end of we also don't have to have a massive team of attorneys and tax specialists to fix this. I have a buddy, good friend of mine, really, really smart guy, and he does the accounting for his local family business, and they own three businesses. So they're not a big operation. They're not, you know, a big corporation or anything like that. They're a small family-run business, and they own three different businesses, and he does their accounting. It takes him literally months for just three businesses to do all of the taxes associated with his family's business. There is no telling how much money they lose and how much productivity that he personally loses having to do all of that. And the way that he describes how complicated it is to get all the taxes right, and these are just for little corporations. Imagine what it takes for a larger corporation. But for his three small family businesses, it takes forever, and it's incredibly stressful. He has to send it back and forth, and they got one little thing wrong on one of the businesses, so they had to start from scratch. It was just a huge convoluted mess. Think about how much money small businesses could save and how that could translate into investing in their employees or investing in equipment which employs other people or even contract out employees. The point is, any of the money that they could spend would be spurring on the economy instead of growing the size and scope of government. And that would be a massive win. So I got to say, thank you, Senator Shelby, for supporting this. I appreciate your commitment to trying to do the best that you can for the people of Alabama and for trying to reduce our taxes. I do appreciate it. I appreciate your consistency on this matter. So that being said, we're going to go ahead and go to the Daily Dose of Stupid.
That was stupid.
I know it was stupid.
Really stupid.
Hey, I just said it was stupid.
All right, so the Daily Dose of Stupid today, it actually does have to do with taxes because, as you recall, yesterday was tax day, and I did notice an interesting trend on Twitter. When I was going on Twitter, I noticed that a lot of the posts that were coming from the left, a lot of those posts were basically based around the idea that the taxes were unpopular. So the tax cuts that went into place, this isn't the first year, it's the second year, but the tax cuts that went into place that were led by the GOP, that were signed into law by President Trump, even though it wasn't a very big tax cut, it was still a tax cut. The left continues to try to paint this as something that only helped millionaires and billionaires and the super wealthy. That is the contention that they have, and that is the narrative that they continue to try to push, despite the fact that there's really not a word of truth to it. And you notice that any of the facts or statistics that they use to try to back up their points all had to do with something completely subjective. For example, one of the ones that I saw is how many people are unhappy with the tax cuts. Yeah, well, whether or not they were unhappy with the tax cuts has very little to do with whether or not the tax cuts actually kept more money in their pockets. You'll see they do this with healthcare all the time. Bernie Sanders, he touts this all the time, even though it really doesn't make any difference. He says, well, there's so many Norwegians or Swedes or people from Finland that just absolutely love their universal healthcare. Yeah, well, they may be satisfied with it, but our survival rates for things like cancer are still higher. By looking at objective standards, our medical system is still way better than anywhere else in the rest of the world. We have more innovation. We have more access to care. I mean, it's by anything objective, you will quickly see that what they're saying doesn't make any difference. And so they constantly have to pivot to and try to put a focus on these completely subjective measures that really don't make any difference. You're not looking at results. You're looking at what people feel about it. And that unfortunately stays true to the overall Democrat worldview, which is people's feelings matter more than facts. They matter more than results. But if you're looking at the actual taxes, the truth is the vast majority of people did see a tax cut and more working families got to keep more of their own money. And Senator Kamala Harris was no different. In the tax day hashtag that you saw that was trending on Twitter, Kamala Harris said that the average tax refund is down $170 compared to last year. Let's call the president's tax cut what it is, a middle class tax hike to line the pockets of the already wealthy corporations and the 1%. So one of two things is happening here. Either Kamala Harris does not understand how taxes work and has a questionable understanding of basic math, or she is intentionally lying. Now, personally, I tend to lean more towards the second half because I don't think that Kamala Harris is just a clueless goober like people like Debbie Wasserman Schultz or Cory Booker. I think that she actually is pretty intelligent. She's wrong, but she is a little bit more intelligent. So I tend to think more that she's lying about this and she's intentionally trying to mislead people. Because here's the issue with that. How much you are paying in taxes is not measured by how much you get on your tax refund. That doesn't make any difference. Because it's the same thing if you were going to a gas station and you said, all right, I need $10 of gas, I need 10 gallons of gas. And they said, okay, we'll give you 10 gallons of gas. And what we're going to do is we're going to charge you, you know, about $2 a gallon. So that'll be $20. Okay. So you hand them $25. They hand you $5 back. Well, that's a $5. You got $5 back. Well, let's say that the next day you show up and they say, well, the price of gas just dropped. We're only going to need about $20. And you hand them $20 and they only give you $2 back. Well, you're paying $2 less because you paid $20 the day before. But because you only got $2 back this time, you're saying, wait. It was more expensive yesterday. You gave me $5 back. No, that's not how this works. The amount that you paid total was less. Just because you got less change back does not mean that you are paying more. It depends on how much you paid up front and how much you owed up front. And that's the thing that this is so incredibly confusing about. It doesn't matter how much the return is as long as you're paying less in the first place. And the thing is, you have to think about it this way too. Your refund is your money. Your taxes are your money. And when they give you back a refund, that is money that the IRS has held interest-free for the entire year over the course of you making money off of your employment, and they give it back to you. That's your money. And so when they give that money to you, A, they're giving you your money back, and B, they're giving you money that they were holding. So if you're getting less money back, that means they were holding on to less of your money. That is a good thing. And it's just so hilarious that Kamala Harris is trying to deceive people like this. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people that are falling for it. You saw how many likes and retweets this thing had. There are a lot of people that see that and are like, you know what? My refund was less. She's right. Trump's screwing me. The GOP is screwing me. I got less money back. This was just a tax hike. This was just a tax cut for the wealthy. Everybody else, it was a tax hike. No, it wasn't a tax hike. They took less of your money to begin with. But anyway, apparently this is something that is true, because if you look, there was a article that was put out, ironically enough, by the New York Times. So the New York Times actually doing some real journalisming, which I have to admit kind of surprised me, but you know, props to the New York Times. They did an article the other day called Face It, You Probably Got a Tax Cut. And one of the things that they brought up is that there was a survey done by SurveyMonkey. I don't know how scientific this poll was, but if you look at it, you'll see in different tax brackets how much each person made and how much believed that they got a tax cut. And on just about every level, the people that believed that they got a tax cut was less than the people that actually got a tax cut. And so if you're looking at it, most of the people, they thought that their taxes either stayed the same or got bigger, but it's not true. And so there is a wild misconception about people that actually got a tax cut but believed that they didn't. And keep in mind, this is coming from the New York Times, not exactly a bastion of conservative thought. They said in this article, to a large degree, the gap between perception and reality on the tax cuts appears to flow from a sustained and misleading effort by liberal opponents of the law to brand it as a broad middle class tax increase. Wow. The New York Times calling out Kamala Harris and those that oppose this tax cut as lying to the American people, saying this was a tax increase for the middle class. So even the New York Times is saying, yeah, the left is full of crap. They're lying about this. And they're saying that it was a intentional and it was a sustained effort to try to mislead the public. So they're not just saying that they're lying about it because they're ignorant or they don't know any better. They're saying, oh no, they know that people are actually getting a tax cut. But there is a sustained effort to try to convince people that they did not, and that is the reason for the massive discrepancy between what people think happened and what actually did happen. It goes on a little later in this article. The Tax Cut Policy Center estimates that 65% of people paid less under the law and that just 6% paid more. The rest saw very little change to their taxes. Other analyses reach similar conclusions. The Joint Committee on Taxation, Congress's nonpartisan team of tax analysts, found that every income group would see a tax cut on average. So did the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, a left-leaning think tank that was sharply critical of the law. In fact, that group went even further. In a December 2017 analysis, it found that every income group in every state would pay less on average under the law in 2019. So the New York Times is saying even this very far left-leaning group that looks at taxes is saying that every demographic, every grouping in every state, and that's significant for a reason that we'll get into in just a second, that every single grouping there actually did see a tax decrease, and this is coming from people that are liberal. So there's really just no way to deny it. This is what happens when you focus on facts and not feelings. If you follow the numbers, the tax break shows a very different reality than what the average person thinks is happening. And then they ask the question later in this article, why don't they believe it? And this is how they responded. The tax savings were relatively small for many families. However, the middle fifth of earners got about $780 tax cut last year on average, according to the Tax Policy Center. Most Americans would probably welcome $780 windfall. But in contrast to 2001, when President George W. Bush's Treasury Department mailed rebate checks to taxpayers, last year's tax cut showed up mostly in the form of lower withholding from workers' paychecks. A few extra dollars in a biweekly paycheck proved easy to miss. Moreover, as taxpayers filed in their returns, many found that they were due smaller refunds than in the past, which may have further skewed perceptions of the law. And this is where the stupid in the Daily Dose of Stupid comes in. You know, you could point to Kamala Harris, but I don't think she's stupid. I think she's just lying. Unfortunately, the stupid is in the average American people, and I hate to say that, but it's the truth. It looks like a vast majority of the American people believe that they did not get a tax cut despite the fact that they actually did. And here's the explanation for that. They're saying that because it showed up in your paycheck every week, as opposed to getting a big check at the end, and people actually getting less in their refunds at the end of the year, even though you actually kept more of your money, they're saying that it wasn't perceived that way. And I really do think that this is one of the main reasons that I really was upset with the Republicans and the way that they handled it. Because you'll remember that when this tax cut was being talked about, I said then that a 2% tax cut is something to be excited about, but it's nothing to act like you won the Super Bowl about. I mean, it's great that we got about a 2%, depending on which bracket you were in. Almost everybody got about a 2% tax cut. That's good. Appreciate that. But really, 2%, that's the best you can do? $780 a year, that's really the best that the Republicans can do when they had the House and the Senate and the presidency? 2%, that's it? I mean, the corporate tax cut was huge, and that's a good thing. But you can see why the news was like, oh, we'll see how big the corporate tax cut is getting, and then the average person, they're just getting these little bitty tax cuts. You see why this myth that these tax cuts were actually benefiting the wealthy? You see how that myth was helped along by the fact that Republicans didn't make a bolder stance when it came to individual taxes? If there had been a cut of about 5 or 10%, I guarantee you this rate would not be nearly as high. Because granted, you divide $780 over 12 months, you're going to see a little bit of an increase. You're going to notice that you have a little bit more spending money, but not that much month to month. Or not that much, certainly, biweekly, if you get paid every 2 weeks. But you know what they would notice? If you were doubling or tripling or quadrupling that amount? I mean, if people have an extra $200 or an extra $2,000 a year, that they're going to pick up on, that they're going to notice. And that's why I was so incredibly critical of them being timid and afraid to actually push for a real, meaningful tax reform on the individual tax side. Because I guarantee you, the GOP's numbers would be better. They'd probably even have bigger numbers in the House and bigger approval ratings if they had actually gone with a bold policy proposal like that. But because they were afraid, and because they didn't want to have less money to play around with in the Congress, because let's face it, most of the Republicans are progressives, they're just progressive light. Because they were afraid of not having a big enough government to be able to help them control your life, they decided, well, we don't really want to get rid of a lot of the money, so what we're going to do is we're just going to give them just a little bitty tax cut. Something cute that they can talk about. If this had been big and bold, even moderates and even some people on the left would be far more likely to understand that they actually got a tax cut. But nonetheless, that is the way that the cookie crumbles, unfortunately, that because they didn't do that, now they're facing the consequences for that, people not even appreciating that they are keeping more of their own money. And it continues on in its explanation. Most people didn't recognize the increase in take-home pay, or at least didn't attribute it to a tax cut, Mr. Ringley said, an expert they were talking on. Some of them might realize now that they're filing their taxes, he said, but it's a little consolation to discover you received a couple thousand dollars during the year, but you already spent it. That's true, and that's one of the reasons that I really favor moving to actually paying taxes as though it were a bill. That's something that I've been in favor of for a while, and I think that that really is something that we ought to move to. I think that that would be beneficial, because when people pay it throughout the year and they get a tax cut, they don't even realize that they got a tax cut, because it's just more money they're keeping in their paycheck every month. If you had to actually make that check out, in other words, the government told you at the end of the month you owe X amount of dollars and you had to physically write a check for that amount at the end of every month, I guarantee you the tax rates would come down. It wouldn't matter if there was a Democrat in the House and the Senate and a Democrat in the White House. If you had Democrat control of those two branches of government completely, taxes would still come down because the American people would not stand for paying the obscene amount of taxes that we pay right now. I mean, when you're working until about middle of March, beginning of April, just for the government, and you're expected to live off of whatever you make the rest of the year, the American people do not stand for that. And if they realized how much they were actually paying and having to take it out of their bank accounts or their pockets, money that they actually possessed and then had to turn over to the government, I guarantee you the way that the tax law is structured would change dramatically. And that's the reason that I actually think that we should be paying at the end of every month as opposed to doing it automatically taken out of our paychecks. They do that so people don't realize how much they're paying in taxes. But nonetheless, that's where we stand, and I find it incredibly disheartening that this is taking place. I do. I understand that for the GOP, it can be very disappointing to see all your hard work basically be for naught, that you're not even getting political recognition for the good that you've been doing for people. But you know what? At the end of the day, whether or not you get gratitude for it, whether or not people thank you for it, that's not really the goal. It's not. As nice as that is, at the end of the day, you did the right thing and more hardworking American families had a little bit more breathing room when it came to their taxes. And that ought to be rewarded in and of itself. I would have been in favor of you giving them a little more breathing room, letting them keep a little more of their own money. But this was a step in the right direction and this was a good thing. And whether or not you get political credit for it, it's good that you did the right thing. These tax cuts are a good thing for the American people, and that in and of itself ought to be celebrated at least a little bit. All right, so let's move to the chaplain's report.
In 1775, the Continental Congress created the Chaplain Corps. Under the command of General George Washington, each soldier was required to attend worship service every Sunday. While other armies advanced on their feet, Washington's troops advanced on their knees. It's time for the Chaplain's Report with Caleb Colquitt on tactics.
Chaplain's Report today does continue our series in the Book of Daniel. And one thing that I wanted to mention real quickly before we get into it is that, once again, Nebuchadnezzar has had a dream, and he needs somebody to interpret that dream. And so he goes to his magicians, and his magicians can't tell him, so he goes really where he should have gone to begin with, to Daniel, the chief of his magicians, the person that he knows can interpret dreams because he's had his dreams interpreted by Daniel before. And so let's look at how this plays out in this verse in the book of Daniel 4, verse 19. Then Daniel, whose name is Belteshazzar, was appalled for a while as his thoughts alarmed him. The king responded and said, Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation alarm you. Belteshazzar replied, My lord, if only the dream applied to those who hate you and its interpretations to you and your adversaries. You see, we'll talk a little bit more about the content of the dream itself probably tomorrow. But what's going on here is that Daniel is living in a time where killing the messenger was not something that was seen as taboo. If a king didn't like what you said, if a king thought that you were bringing him unfavorable news, they could kill you, and very often did. Even in Israel, a place where obviously that would have been frowned upon, killing one of God's prophets, even in Israel, it was not that uncommon for prophets to be killed by those in power. Actually killed by people who didn't like what they were saying, didn't like the message. You can fast forward, and that was true even in the New Testament years later. You remember what happened to John the Baptist with Herod. And so Daniel understands that even though this is going to be something that Nebuchadnezzar is going to hear and really not like, he understands that this interpretation is going to be something that is dangerous for him to say because of how powerful Nebuchadnezzar is. He's afraid of what's going to happen to him because he tells him this interpretation and what it means, because it's going to be unflattering to him. And yet, even though Daniel's afraid, you're about to see that he tells the truth, because Daniel has too much respect for the truth to lie. He has too much respect for God's word. And another thing that I think Daniel may have thought about as well, and it doesn't say this in the scripture, I'm not trying to get inside Daniel's head, but maybe one thing that he considered, and I hope that he did, is if God sent this man this dream, and I'm here and he knows that I can interpret dreams, then regardless of what happens to me, God wants this man to have this information. And I'm God's mouthpiece, I'm his prophet, and so because of that, I'm supposed to tell him what the dream means. If God put me in this situation, then I'm supposed to be honest and tell him the truth, and not worry so much about my own safety, because this is obviously a message that God wants to get to Nebuchadnezzar. And so, not only did he see it from the perspective of, I respect the truth, therefore I'm going to do this, he also, I think, saw it from the perspective of, God wants him to have this message, and I'm going to do what God asks of me. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics is a production of News Radio 1440 and Cumulus Media Montgomery. Any opinions expressed on this program are those of the host and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Cumulus Media. The theme song for Tactics is 6 Foot Town by Big and Rich. Graphics by Jessica Dawson. Broadcast studios provided by Cumulus Media Montgomery. Location studios provided by the Dalreda Church of Christ. Copyright 2019.